welcome to this week's Inside Education. Our website is insideed.com, where you can listen to or download podcasts of all previous Inside Education programmes. I'm Sean Delaney and I'll be your host for the next 30 minutes or so. This week we explore the teaching of poetry in the primary school, in the company of a man who can best be described as a teacher-philosopher. John Doyle spent most of his career teaching primary school children in St. Bridget's National School in Castleknock. But throughout that career, he read deeply and widely, reflected on his teaching, and he wrote. I first met John Doyle back in the mid-1980s when I had the good fortune to be placed as a student teacher in his class. We've kept in touch over the years, and John's ideas about teaching have both inspired and challenged me during that time. John retired from teaching a couple of years ago, and shortly after he retired, I recorded some interviews with him over a number of weeks. This week, I bring you an excerpt from one of those interviews. One word that comes up again and again in the interview is animate, or animating. John, earlier in the interview, had described how he sees teaching as the act of animation. Animation means giving things a soul, he said. Giving things heart and opening the world so that the world is animated and animating. John loves poetry and teaching poetry. When I was a student in John's class, I remember him advising me that there are three stages when teaching a poem, and they are in order: appreciation, understanding, and response. When we spoke, I asked John to elaborate on this idea.
Well, I love poetry. And again, what is poetry? For me, poetry is pure animation. So many things animate, but poetry is animation. And a poet is trying to create the animating word. It's difficult. So, okay, I'm doing a poem with a child. Doing it means I introduce children to poems that animate me, first of all. So let's say there's 1,000 poems out there. I don't try to just pick one. I let one come to me, one that means something to me. And then I share it. I find if it's new to children, what I do is I don't give them out a copy of it. I read it to them. And I tell them, just listen. You may not understand very much, just listen. And then I read it again. Just listen. And then I'll read it again. Just listen. And then I ask them, did any word or phrase strike you? Anything. And there's a time then for gathering. It's like a harvest of impressions. All the little bits of this, that and the other day. And sometimes, at first it seems they've remembered nothing. But one child remembers this, another child remembers that. One child remembers something that connects with what another child remembered. And they're reconstructing the poem. Now, they never completely reconstruct it, of course. But I take that now as very important. And then I read it again. And all those things which they said fall back into place. And they're illuminated by the whole poem again. So what's actually happening is I could do this as much as is necessary. At a certain point, I give them all a copy of the poem and we read it together and they read it. I kind of look, anyone like to try and read it? And then who could read it, make it more a spell? Because I've always communicated to them that poetry is making a spell. There's the spell maker, the designer of the spell, and then there's the actual one who performs and casts the spell. You know, can you cast the spell which the poet has made? You can't unless you feel it, unless you become the spell. So it's fairly informal, but it's also rigorous in the sense that I hold out for more and more and more. And some children read. And then I let children judge who was better, who thinks they can do better than that. And then I ask children, did they do better than that? And little by little, it's in play. Where is the spell? Who who's able to take the spell, who can actually cast the spell, who can take the baton, who can run with the baton. And that takes its own time. You can't really rush it. But then after a while, I'd be asking questions like what's going on here? What's at stake in this poem? What's important? If the writer could only take one line with him out of the poem and leave the rest, what line would they take? What line would you take? Why would you take it? Why could so much depend on that line? I wonder, was the poem written to lead to that line? And how did the poet do it? And are there any other poems that are doing the same thing, that are trying to bring you really to that line, even if that line is not in those poems? It's the same point. And then I might have loads of books of poetry.
Are there any particular poems, John, that you remember teaching that the children responded well to?
I think most teachers would concur with me that there's something about On Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost that children take to, but whether they fully understand it or not is open. They take to it. Or The Road Not Taken, also by Robert Frost. Or An Irish Airman Foresees His Death by Yeats. Or The Song of Wandering Agans, also by Yeats. These are poems I would come back to again and again, but I'd often then work away from these poems to other poems, cognate poems, poems that have something of the same feeling in them. And it's very hard to know what that is, but I think many poems speak unto poem. There's no such thing as just a few poems. There's a landscape of poems. And I'm just looking in a bag I have here just to see, can I vindicate that right now? I'm opening a book of poetry. I'm just opening it at the beginning. This is one of my favourite poets, Christina Rossetti. I love her poetry. And I'm going to read a poem of hers. When I'm introducing children to a poem, there's the poem and there's the poetry. There's the spell and there's the spell-binding quality. There's something that stops you short and makes you listen and makes you look far away. Here's a poem. Cobwebs. It is a land with neither night nor day, nor heat nor cold, nor any wind nor rain, nor hills nor valleys, but one even plain stretches through long, unbroken miles away, while through the sluggish air a twilight grey broodeth. No moons or seasons wax and wane, no ebb and flow are there along the main, no bud time, no leaf falling there for a, no ripple on the sea, no shifting sand, no beat of wings to stir the stagnant space, no pulse of life through all the loveless land and loveless sea, no trace of days before, no guarded home, no toil-won resting place, no future hope, no fear forevermore. Now, I think that's a wonderful poem. And, you know, many questions arise at a chant, you know, and each child could have a piece, you know, each child could chant a line. But it's neither this, nor this, nor this, nor this, nor this, nor this. At what point does life fail? This is a counterspell, this spell. This is a spell on life. It's like the blast of a cold wind. What zone are we in? What's it like there?
And what are the cobwebs?
And what are the cobwebs? Death. This is after death. We've actually entered death. And we're looking back at life from death. Would we want to be there? And then things begin to look beautiful from there. In other words, we start to reinvoke. We could write a lot of poems. We could write a poem called Night. We could write a poem called Day. We could write a poem called Heat. We could write a poem called Cold. We could write a poem called Wind. We could write a poem called Rain, calling them back. And if we can actually make the poem, we can go back and live all these things.
And would you have any, say, concerns about doing a poem like that with children that deals with the theme of death so strongly? Because it might frighten them, or it might, you know, have them maybe worried in the evenings.
Well, now, I would take that quite seriously. My own view is, of course I would introduce death, but I wouldn't introduce death just to shock and drop it. I think if you introduce that to children, you work through it, you work with it. You don't want to end with death having the last word. It's a curve. In other words, that poem there now, it's a very profound poem. And to me, what it's about is the de-animation of life. It's life seen as totally inanimate, de-animated. The magic has fled. The spell is broken. So there is a spell. So it leads you back to search for spells. And that poem could like a portal to many poems which would strongly affirm life, rejoice in life, poems of joy. And you realise that, you know, English poetry, it's an amazing treasure, a store of a range of feeling. And that's what we're really searching for, the range of human feeling.
Even the last line in that poem is strangely optimistic, even though it's from death, it's no fear forevermore.
You might say it's eternal rest. But if it is eternal rest, it's not may they rest in peace. It's a kind of a dead rest. You've come to a dead end.
Are there particular themes that children really like in poems, John, that you would look for when you're choosing poems? And I know you kind of said you don't choose them, they choose you, but are there particular themes that children enjoy more than others?
Children, I think, enjoy poems that are funny and short. They like lots of poo and goo. You know, they like it to be made to laugh by a poem, by a situation. For example, there's a book, the Puffin Book of Children's Poetry, I think it's called. And I read it a number of times. And there's some very good poems. But what I notice about it, it's a very modern collection. What I notice about it is that I think too many of the poems are funny, haha. Too many of them are show-off. Too many of them are scallywag. In other words, the narrator is a bit of a boyo, an imp. Too much, the poet identifies too much with this rebellious energy in children. And children love this. There have been writers, stories, who identify with this as well, and children love this. The rebel, who gets away with it, or basically stares them down. There are a lot of poems like that, but they're also, I would say, poems with more feeling. Poetry is an exploration of the possibilities of enchantment. That poem I may have read to you now, it seems like a totally disenchanted poem. But it disenchants you enchantingly. So,
what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is, it's still a poem. It has a rhyme, a rhythm, a pattern. Once it has those things, it's casting a spell on you. Because we love those things. I mean, I myself, I think I love most in poetry. What? Repetition. That's what I love most in poetry. Now, most modern poetry doesn't go in for repetition because it's kind of like a waste of words. Why would you say it twice when you've... But, I mean, think of that poem now on stopping by the woods on a snowy evening. There is repetition there at the end where... But I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep. And miles to go before I sleep. Why is that last line repeated so emphatically? And that's in a way the secret of poetry. The emphasis. Sometimes the emphasis comes from where something is placed. Sometimes it comes from repeating. And repeating leads to chanting. And chanting leads to a kind of trance. You know, prayers. Prayers. I think of a litany, like the litany of the Blessed Virgin. And it's a chant. And it's all these names, amazing names, these Latin names of Mary. And you're just asking the same one, pray for us. Now that's a chant. Is that a poem? I leave others to judge. But to me it is a poem, this deep repetition. The difference in this case is you really mean it. You're counting on it, as if you can somehow bring something good about.
And what you're touching on there as well, John, is the importance of sound in poetry, which is probably what one of the things that distinguishes it from prose. How do you encourage children to understand the importance of sound in poetry?
Again, these questions, in a way, they're beyond me. You know, I have a feeling for some things. I think in speech, I think vowels matter. Vowels, they go with our breath. They are animating. And we control that animation by consonants. Consonants, like our chisel, we're sculpting the breath. But the sounds, they come from the heart. They come from deep down, these vowel sounds. And I would say when I'm reading a poem, I lean into the vowels. So it's not as if I just teach the children this. They pick it up. and they learn to read the poem. You see, when children start reading poems, they say, oh, this is a poem. They read the poem, but they read it, they rush through it. They canter through the poem. It's as if the form of the poem, they're very responsive to the formal qualities of the sound, but what gets missing is the sense. Now, sound matters profoundly in a poem. But I'm saying if a poet does his or her job well, it takes care of itself. In general, what I would say to children is, give me the sense, and the sound will take care of itself.
So in other words, that will avoid the rhyming off of da 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 da.
Exactly. But the poet put all that there to make it easier to say, easier to remember, easier to recite, so that you wouldn't lose your nerve or lose the thread. But the poet makes it easy for you. But the poet doesn't finally do it for you. You actually have to make sense of the poem, and you have to make it make sense to listeners. You have to animate it. This bird has to fly out. And you can do it. Children can do it. They can learn to do it, little by little, without making a big fuss about chattering away. I remember a moment in a film which I show every single year to children, every single year since it came out, every single year, on some excuse or other, I show the film Empire of the Sun to a class. And I show it like a poem. It's slow. We talk a lot about it, and it might take a week or 2 weeks to see it after much discussion. But there is a moment in that, just a moment, where in the middle of the chaos of a camp, a kind of prisoner camp, they're not prisoners of war because they're not soldiers, but they're bet up civilians on a very low diet and slowly succumbing to all kinds of diseases, mostly malaria. But there's a doctor looking after a number of them in a far too inadequate hospital room, and he has somehow dedicated himself to look after this boy and bring him up because he has no father and mother. He was separated from them early on. And he's teaching that boy Latin. And not only teaching him, but checking that he knows it. Amo amas amat, amamas amatis, amant. And also poetry. And the boy recites the poem. And the doctor, no. The boy recites the poem like most children do. Just canters through it, making no sense. And he tries to slow it down in the midst of chaos, because people are actually dying in that room. And I just said, here is a doctor in the middle of the Second World War, far from home, trying to give a quasi-grammar school education to a little wild boy who spent most of his time hustling in the camp, bargaining and huckstering. What I'm saying is, it was a surprise to find a poem there at all, and to see how the boy is saying the poem with his mind on something else entirely, and yet the poem could be said through him because it was so constructed that that's what poems can do, they can be said. But if he brought his mind to it and made sense of it, it would speak to him as well as speaking through him. Anyway, I'm just saying, I have no list of things that I want to teach to children. Poetry in English, there's poetry in French, there's poetry in German. It's all animating. animating that language, animating that world. This is our language, this is our world, and it's wondrous.
Are there particular poets, John, who write poems for children that you particularly like or that you find yourself returning to?
I tend to draw poems from all kinds of sources. Again, not necessarily from any source within the classroom. For example, lots of readers nowadays have a section at the back, a poetry section. And the poems are fun. They're good. But they're not that good that I would keep recurring to them. I tend to take poems from my own reading of poetry. And if someone is currently speaking to me, there's a good chance I'll find a poem that will speak to children.
And Yeats and Christina Rossetti are too.
Yes, yes. When I go to any poem, I look for the tensions. Sometimes they're explicit, sometimes they're not. But they can be in any poem. So obviously I have to find poems that will appeal to children. But a lot of poems will appeal if you take your time with them. Sometimes you have to unpeel a poem, like unpeeling a fruit. It's luscious, but you have to take your time. So I'm not prepared to say there are poems just written for children. There is a lovely book called, by the way, The Book of 1,000 Poems, which I have often used and which I love to read myself. And I would share poems from that with children. Now, you know, I would share, generally, they're very accessible and they're teaching children. They're a kind of an apprenticeship, you know, a rich and long apprenticeship to poetry. And if I could recommend only one book to a teacher, I'd say The Book of 1,000 Poems will take you very far, very, very far. From nursery rhymes. And it actually sounds out all the great themes of English poetry. Like, what would English poetry be without, say, spring, summer, autumn, winter? Do you know what I mean? What would it be? I'm saying you need a book that is generous in its choice. And I think that is a great book. And it's for the youngest children, right up to the oldest teacher. There's something in it. But I wouldn't be, it's a book of introduction. It's not a book of constraint. You know, many of the great poets, the great English poets, are not in it at all. Many very minor poets are in it. But each one can be minor. But the overall richness, it's like each brings something to the feast. And what a feast.
And that was John Doyle whetting our appetite for the teaching of poetry. Well, we just have one item on the education notice board this week, and that is from the National Centre for Guidance in Education. They have a national conference on guidance coming up on Friday, the 1st of March 2013. The theme of this one-day conference will be Lifelong Guidance, Building the Evidence Base, and will also mark the first meeting of the National Forum on Guidance 2013-2014. The conference will launch a national process to gather relevant data and evidence in all sectors of lifelong guidance to inform policy in line with our European partners in the European Lifelong Guidance Policy Network. And to find out more about the conference, you can contact a member of the NCGE staff on 01869 0715. That number again to attend the, or to find out more about the National Conference on Guidance, which is on Friday the 1st of March, is 01869 0715. Well, that's about all we have time for on this week's Inside Education. You can get in touch with the programme by email at insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie, or you can go onto the programme's website to download podcasts or to find out anything else about the programme. The website address is insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.